Hello, this is the Commentator's Curse. I'm Ian Danta, and for about 20-odd years now, I've been working as a match commentator on the radio for both local and national radio. Everywhere I go, every ground I visit, I bump into good people like myself who do the same job as me, only a very different job somehow. And everybody's got a different story to tell about how they got there and how they've stayed there. That's what this podcast is all about. It's all about lifting the lid on the weird old world that commentators inhabit and how they manage to enter this weird old world, because everybody does have a different story to tell. There's an archive of episodes for you to delve into at your leisure. I think we're up to 8 at this point, starting with Guy Mowbray and Ian Crocker in episode 1. And the last episode, the most recent, was Jackie Oatley and Rob Phillips from BBC Radio Wales. So feel free to delve into the archive if you found this one, first of all, and spread the word. Be very kind of you. Let's introduce our two guests for this week's Commentator's Curse. First of all, a chap who I've got to know because he has worked at TalkSport on and off in the time that I've known him, but he's predominantly known as one of the Premier League commentators for Sky Sports on the match choice option that you get at the weekend. But he also works for a number of other broadcasters away from his Saturday commitments with Sky. And he's quite important to anybody watching this who is a broadcast student or at university. This gentleman gives you opportunities, and we'll talk more about that with Gary Taphouse as we go. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Dance. Thanks for having me on. I have listened to some of those archive episodes on many trips up and down the motorway, so many thanks. It's been great fun.
Well, there we go. Let's see if we can contribute with this one and just listen back to yourself. Would you listen back to yourself, though?
That's the thing.
God, commentators don't generally. My other guest is a guy I've known for a very, very long time, who's one of those who's made the leap not only from commercial to the BBC, but also from radio to television, although he still works on radio for 5 Live, but he's predominantly known as one of the main commentator voices on BT Sport, and he does football, but he's a guy that's become quite versatile over the years and done a bit of American sport commentary, which I'd like to talk to him about at some stage. It's Darren Fletcher from BT Sport. Fletch, how are you?
Very good, mate. How are you?
Yes, we're all rocking and rolling here. I must immediately, as you know, Gary, I have already, well, I didn't mention you by name, but I have kind of half unmasked you on previous episodes. You are the gentleman who commentates in his stocking feet in the winter with your feet on a heated pad.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I'm a soft southerner. What can I say? Yeah, I decided to invest in one, a game changer as far as I'm concerned, as we start to get into the winter months. Little grey heated pad, shoes off, socks onto the pad, lovely toasty feet. What can I say? Listen, it works for me.
See, I blame Higginbottom for all of this, for starting this heated relay nonsense. Because it's
true.
For this. This is the logical conclusion that we've led to. Well, as you say, but then I'm just waiting. If ever there was a power outage at the Vitality or at St Mary's, I'd be looking straight at you, Gary. I'd be thinking he's plugged that thing in and caused a shortage.
Well, I think, yeah, I'd be more worried about being off air, but you're right. No, it did start with Danny Higginbottom because we were doing a game at Huddersfield in the snow, and it really was the coldest I've ever been at a game. And he invested in a heated coat, but he also had about 5 pairs of thermal socks on, and he just said, I can't stand the cold. I hated being a substitute because I just sit there getting cold. And I thought, wow, what a brilliant idea. So I just looked at other ways of staying warm. And I think I've out-Dannied now with the heated blanket.
Darren's face alone when you mentioned, he's not having it.
No. What's that, heat pads in your socks? Just, come on.
It works for me. What can I say?
What's the coldest you've ever been at a game, Fletch? Can you recall any particular evening where it was just too much?
Yeah, I was with Robbie Savage at Huddersfield for a match. I can't recall who they were playing in the Premier League when they were up. And it was freezing. I mean, Sav, bless him, he didn't like the cold either. So Sav managed to find blankets and all sorts and other people's clothes. And he was just kind of, he'd almost managed to make a bivouac around him in the commentary box. But you just got to go through. I tell you what I find really good about Gary is the fact that every time anybody does a an image of a commentator. It involves a lip mic. Gary's even got one of those today. With a laptop, he's managed to get the lip mic in as well. So you can never actually see Gary's face properly.
You've gone method, Gary. That's what you've done today.
I've got a sound card plugged into the laptop and then a lip mic plugged into the sound card. So
the important question, though, guys, are you warm enough as we're speaking at the moment?
Do you know what? We haven't even put the heating on yet. I'm quite proud of myself.
But good lad.
It's coming.
Good lad. Well, it must be something about Huddersfield as well, as you both mentioned that as the coldest place you've ever worked. There's a coincidence to even get started with. All right, let's delve back into ancient history, if you don't mind, gents, and the path that took you to sort of getting onto the first couple of rungs of the ladder. Fletch, I knew you from coming through in Nottinghamshire, of course, at Nottingham Forest. By the time you'd got on air in that part of the Midlands, I think Brian Clough's reign at Nottingham Forest was coming towards an end, but you did. Well, I'd love to know how you got to that point first. Was radio always in the plans for you as a lad growing up?
No, and this is probably why I don't need thermal heat pads under my feet at Huddersfield. I actually worked on a building site. So I used to put up suspended ceilings. So I completely wasted all of my efforts and time at school. And completely let the family down. I think they got these grandiose ideas that I might be intelligent, but I didn't think I was. I certainly didn't have the application to be intelligent. So I pretty much wasted whatever opportunity school gave me. And I ended up laboring on a building site in Sheffield. And what it was, they were rebuilding the Lyceum Theatre, which is basically opposite the Crucible where they have the snooker. So me and two of my mates were the suspended ceiling gang. So there was this huge rebuild going on. So that's kind of what I did. And I did this during the winter of 89 into 90 and then through the summer of 1990 during the World Cup. But my parents were kind of, look, you know, you're wasting your life. And I couldn't see this at the time. I'm a teenager and I'm like, no, this is great. You know, it's a 100 quid cash in my pocket, which I can spend down the pub on a Friday and Saturday. So this was life. But at that point, it seemed great. But my dad was an accountant and he acted for a guy that owned a gym in Nottingham. And one of the people that trained in the gym was the sports editor at Radio Trent, a guy called Tony Della Hunte, who had a wonderful broadcasting career. Tony had a PR company as well, called Tony Della Hunte Associates. And they were covering various events outside of his radio remit because he was a sports editor at Radio Trent in Nottingham. But they needed a runner, basically, to work on this particular event that was called the Sun Life Great Race. And it was a running race from Glasgow to London over 3 weeks. And it was a half marathon a day, essentially, for the runners. And they ran in teams. The leader wore a yellow vest, very similar to the Tour de France. And they made their way down the country from Glasgow to London running this stage race. Only ever happened once. And he needed somebody to be the dog's body on there. So I get put forward. So I can go back to the suspended ceilings as and when, because this glorious career awaits putting up these things, which I could barely hold, never mind about put up. I mean, they were awful things, especially when it was windy. So I went off to Glasgow to do this event. And the first thing we ever did was the World Speedway Final at Bradford. And I was smuggled into the stadium in this camper because they'd only got one pass. So I'm thinking, this is not what he's cracked up to me. This is supposed to be a glamorous job. So I ended up doing this Sun Life Great Race. And I was told quite categorically, you know, you're not broadcasting, you're a builder. Just go and fetch the tea and get the results and make sure everybody's got what they want. But I also got to file copy. So Tony would write the copy and I'd file the copy into the desk. But this particular day, I got put to air. So I'm kind of sat there. Now I'm live on air with this presenter, fresh off a building site, no idea what you do. And just kind of said, as I do now, the first thing that came into my head. And on this occasion, it kind of came out okay. So Tony said, have you just been on the air? So I said, yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm thinking I'm going to get sent home, you know, because he told me not to. Anyway, so that was fine. He said, don't do it again. He said, you actually did a good job there. That was fine. That was fine. So the end of the Sun Life Great Race, I got called into the office on the Monday to get paid. He paid me, he was going to pay me 300 quid, which kind of matched my, for 3 weeks, which matched my huge salary on the building site at that time. So I was going in to collect me 300 quid. And he sat me down. He said, look, I'm going to offer you a job. So I said, all right. So he said, yeah, you come and work here and I'll teach you everything. And if you listen, you've got half a chance to make something of yourself. He said, but if you don't, you'll be back where you were. So I said, great. So he said, right, I want your mum and dad in. So they had to go in because I was only a teenager. So so they went in and he kind of sat them down and said, look, I'm going to give him an opportunity and I'm going to be his mentor, so to speak, and I'm going to try and teach him how to do the job. So I started off, I mean, I wasn't at the bottom. I was lower than that, and as low as you can be in a radio station. I mean, you've been there, so you know what it's like. I mean, every job that nobody wanted to do, I did, and I was there 10 days a week, it felt like. You know, I mean, everybody went home, I was still there. And something clicked early on that was kind of, if you actually listen here and take on board what this fella's saying to you, you could actually have a job that involves not carrying big suspended ceiling panels up the outside of a building with no walls in the winter, and it would make perfect sense. And I've always been mad on sport, but just, I got told by a careers teacher when I was like 14, you know, forget about that. You know, you can't do that. That's not a proper job. So that was like, well, what am I going to do then? Well, why don't you go into advertising? Well, I don't want to do advertising. I like sport. So this was an opportunity to work in sport. And kind of over the time, over that period under Tony, who did everything that he said he would do and more, and without his dedication and belief and the opportunity, I would be nowhere now. And I owe everything to him and various other people along the journey, by the way. But he did what he said he'd do. And he managed to get me in some bizarre way to be a broadcaster. And then it's tiny steps from there. Yeah. And he was one of those guys that he would just throw you in and just say, well, go and do that. It wasn't a case of, you can't do that yet. He would say, just go and do it. And if you mess it up, then it's kind of on you. And I've always responded to that. I'd sooner do that than somebody go, well, you can't yet. I'd sooner go, well, go and do it. And then we'll work it out. So when he'd offered me the job, the first thing he asked me to do was go to the City Ground and do an interview. So I said, well, who with? You know, I have no idea how this works. I've not been on a broadcast journalism course. I've not been to university. I've got no idea how this works. So I've gone from being a Forest fan, stood in the Trent End buying a ticket, to now being told by this bloke to take this microphone machine down to the City Ground and go and speak to one of the players who I'd probably never spoken to in my life before. So, I mean, I'm literally dying 1,000 deaths, so frightened about doing it. So I drive down to the City Ground and I walked into the office, and Brian was the manager at the time. This was 1990, so I had 3 years of Brian and a few years after when he retired, which was magical. And I walked into the office, and just being stood in the office was enough because I'd never been in there. This was the inner sanctum of the City Ground. Supporters don't go in there. So all this was like mad. This was a real mess of my head. And I was sweating and I was nervous. And a lady came to the desk who it transpired was Carol, who was Brian's secretary. And she said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, I've come to do an interview. So she said, who with? So I kind of said, Brian Clough. So she went, all right, okay. Where are you from? So I said, Radio Trent. So I said, Tony De La Hunte sent me. So she went, all right, we'll take a seat. And I'll see if the manager wants to speak to you today. So I got to sit outside and she came back and she went, yes, he'll speak to you if you sit there. So I sat there for what must have been 3 hours. I mean, I literally never moved. I mean, he kept walking out and back again. I'm thinking, there's Brian Clough. That is Brian Clough. And all I want to do is say, can I have your autograph? I love you. And I can't because I'm sat there, you know, I'm a Forest fan. So I eventually get called down. I walk into this room with this ewer, the old ewer, and a list of questions that I'd scribbled down on a bit of paper. And in the room was Brian, Archie Gemmell, Ron Fenton, and Alan Hill, whole management team, and me. So now I am lit. I should have run out of sweat by now, but I'd found some from somewhere. I mean, I am literally pouring. So I sit down and I'm shaking like a leaf. I mean, I'm absolutely, the microphone, all you can hear, when I get the interview back, all you can hear is, because it's me shaking the mic lead. You know what they were like, the old Jew. So he said to me, get a voice level for yourself then. So I get this voice level on the UR, and I've got the questions in front of me like this. And he, as I start asking the first question, he leaned across and just took the questions and screwed them up and pulled them back and dropped them on the floor. Now I am gone, by the way. I am now gone. So I somehow burbled my way through this interview. They were playing Man United at the weekend. I remember they played Man United at the weekend in a league match. And I said to him at one stage, as a fan, you know, you've made a bit of a mediocre start to the season. He said, mediocre? He said, that's a good word for you, son. He said, you're not talking about this interview, are you? Because I think this is mediocre. So that's got me down to another level. So any confidence I've now built up was gone. But at the end of it, when I'd done it, he said, I've really enjoyed that, son. He said, come back and see me again. So I now think I'm Brian Clough's mate. I'm not a fan anymore. I'm Clough's mate. I didn't realise he said this to everybody. So I get back to the studio and they've gone, well, who did you get? And I said, oh, Brian Clough. I was winding him up because he didn't do interviews. Really, he kind of called you and said that. So I got this Cloughy interview that ended up on IRN. I mean, it took a lot of cutting, by the way. I mean, it didn't sound anything like it sounded when I got it back by the time they sent it down there. And they made me sound semi-intelligent, which is not an easy thing to do, as you know, Dan. So I sounded semi-intelligent. The interview went to IRN. And that was kind of, I started on maybe the Tuesday, and that was on the Friday of my first week off a building site. And from that moment on, I remember thinking, well, you're never going to be as nervous as that. You're never going to be as bad as that. So it's got to be improvement from here. So that was kind of how I got there and what I initially did. And I can remember every second of that, and I'll never forget it. It's indelibly marked on my body.
It really Yeah. It's everyone has that moment where you're thrust into it, and Tom Ross thrusting a ISDN kit at me and said, you're going to Warsaw Saturday. 2 days before, what the flip? I mean, what? So that's being thrown in at the deep end. But he wouldn't have done it, and the same way that Tony wouldn't have done it with you if he didn't believe in you. And Tom was the same with those who he got an inkling about. He thought, well, there's something about you that I think I can trust to throw something at you, and you won't let me down.
Yeah, he was a bloody good judge because nobody else could see it. I don't know what he does now, but he could see very, very deeply into my soul, I'll tell you.
Well, they're all still trying to get us out, aren't they, one way or another? That's what Tom always says to me anyway. I've got you in this business and I can get you out. It's one of his most famous catchphrases. Gary, when we come to you, your origins, I know that Capital Radio plays a part in your formative years, but again, as with Fletch, was radio ever a plan or ever a career path that you had as a school kid?
Well, it's funny hearing Fletch say not a proper job, because I had that very conversation as well. I remember watching Italia 90. I've pretty much watched every game, and I was as much interested in what was happening with the commentary as I was with the football. I remember saying to my dad, is that actually a proper job? Does someone get paid to comment, to basically be excited about a match and talk to people? And I just couldn't believe that was a job. And so I thought that, you know, that's exactly what I want to do. So a bit different to Fletch, I did actually go to university. I did do a journalism course.
Where was this, Gary? Which part?
Was at Bournemouth University.
Right.
I'd never been to Bournemouth in my life. And of course, I now live here with my family. Because it had such an impact on me. And I was very lucky that in my final year at Bournemouth, an opportunity came up to commentate on Bournemouth home games for the club. They were third tier at the time, had no money at all. And one of my housemates was going out with an older guy who was a cameraman for a local production company. And I overheard him say, we're filming all of Bournemouth's home games for the club, but we need a commentator because we're using someone who works for the club and he's not very good. And I just said, excuse me, I'd love to do that. Can I give it a go? And that's how it started. I ended up writing and presenting the end of season VHS video that season for Bournemouth, which you could actually buy in HMV in Bournemouth. I walked in, I just couldn't believe that something that I had written and presented was there. I mean, it was absolutely dreadful, of course, and I was dreadful, but it meant that I left uni with something in my hand that I could show to people that I could actually do the job, and that I'd sat there with, you know, one camera and me with a microphone attached to the camera commentating. But I thought, oh, I'll just walk into a sports broadcasting job now, and of course that's not how it worked. Those jobs are very hard to find, and I ended up going to be a reporter on my local paper doing news and, you know, covering the crime of Croydon and the various quirky folk of South London, on the South London Guardian, and I would be then at weekends, an opportunity came up to work for Crystal Palace because they just launched their own radio station. And I was invited to the launch to cover it. And again, I just ingratiated myself and said, look, I'd really like to do some commentary. I showed him my video and he said, come along to the next game, which was against Chelsea. And I did that game. And of course, I'd never done radio. So they queued to me and I had a little script written and then I just stopped. And they were just saying in my ear, Gary, you've got to keep talking. It's radio. And yeah, that was a real sort of baptism of fire. And basically as a result of that, Capital Radio were always at Palace, obviously. And I got to know those guys really well. And of course, if you're in London at that time in the 90s, it was all about Capital Gold, Jonathan Pearce, what he'd done there. An incredible team of guys he had, like Steve Wilson, Rob Watton, Julian Walters. And I listened to those guys absolutely religiously. I mean, I was a proper radio nerd then. I was recording them and listening back to it. And I managed to get an opportunity thanks to Dominic Johnson, who was also one of the commentators there.
Yeah.
And he said, can you do Fulham in the FA Cup first round? I think they were playing Northampton. And I got there with my ISDN kit, which I'd never used, at 12 noon for a 3 o'clock game. And I sat there and didn't move for the entire sort of 6 hours, listening to all the, you know, the build up in my ears as people were arriving and plugging in. And I went from listening religiously to Jonathan Pearce on the radio, and suddenly he was then cueing me to talk about a goal. And I just thought at that point, I've made it. You know, that to me was the most exciting thing that had ever happened in my life, I think. And he rang me and said, yeah, you did a good job there. Make sure you do a better job next time. And, you know, he could be tough. He would sometimes ring and say, you know, that was rubbish, or why did you do that? You shouldn't have done that. And, you know, he was really, really tough. And of course, I've since tried to remind him of these various moments and he completely denies it. But, you know, it was about learning, as you say, being thrown in and learning. And I was going up to Grimsby for 38 quid to be there for 6 hours and to always be available. I'd probably be on air three or four times. But to me, it was just the most exciting thing that had ever happened. And so I was doing that at weekends and I got a job at Opta. That's the first time I actually worked in football. They were a very small company at the time, only about half a dozen employees. And I was one of the journalists. So I was doing that during the week. I was doing Capital at the weekends. So I didn't actually go into a full-time broadcasting job until the opportunity came up at Chelsea. And that by then I was 25. So it took a really, really long time to actually get working full-time in broadcasting. But, you know, that was an amazing opportunity because then I was commentating on every Chelsea game, home and away, you know, flying off with the team in the Champions League. That, you know, incredible experience working with Kerry Dixon every week. And you know, that's how I got to know everyone at Sky, because you know, Abramovich had bought the club and they were covering every game, so I got to know all the commentators, and eventually the chance came up to do a game for Sky. So that's a sort of mini breaks along the way.
Yeah, it was all sliding doors moments, is it, for everybody. And I think your two stories kind of sum up the vast divide between how people get started in this business, either working as a labourer like Fletch was, or you, Gary, sort of taking, if you will, the traditional route that lots of people certainly now take with all these vocational courses that are so designed to get people a media studies degree and whatnot. It just shows you how many different routes there can be. Fletch, you've already cross-referenced your first meeting with Brian Clough. And when I read that, there's two wonderful books out there of sort of Cloughy stories, and you have contributed to those. And as you mentioned, you had 3 or 4 years working sort of in his shadow. One thing that struck me about those books about Brian Clough was that he had this incredible ability to make everybody think that they were his closest confidant and they were the ones getting all the exclusives that nobody else was getting. But the reality was he was playing you all off against one another. And one week you were, you know, a broadcasting titan. Next week he was using the S-housery word at you.
Yeah. what we realised later on, when you get a bit more streetwise, is he had two people that he gave the stories to. John Lawson was one, John Sadler was the other, because he had a contract with the Sun, and the rest of us kind of waited until we got asked. I was in quite a fortunate position because there was the BBC local station, Radio Nottingham, and then there was us at Radio Trent. And he didn't particularly have a great fondness, I don't think, for Martin Fisher for some reason. Martin was the sports editor at Radio Nottingham. Great mate of mine, known him ever since I started. And I remember being stood there one day, it was a Friday, and we're all kind of gathered in the corridor outside the office to see which was going to be asked to go in, you know, because we got wind of the fact he was going to talk that day. And he came out and he pulled a piece of paper out of his pocket and he said, "Which one's Fisher?" So Martin's hand shot up faster than the eager kid in the classroom, you know. So he said, "All right." So he starts reading these quotes off Martin's commentary album that somebody had given him. And he was caning Gary Crosby and he was battering all these people. "Did you say that, son?" he said. Because Martin's dying 1,000 deaths now because we're all stood there. So he said, "I tell you what I'm going to do, son." He said, "I'm going to sue you." So we're all stood there. We're thinking, "Oh, no." So he then said, "And who's your producer, son?" At which point Martin said, "I produced the programme as well." He went, "Oh, brilliant. I'll sue you twice." He then took every one of us into the office and did an interview with us and left Martin outside. But that was the way it went. He got eyes everywhere, ears everywhere, and everything was going off. And we had another one. And I don't even know if I don't know if Martin's ever told the story, but I think we can probably tell it now. When Brian retired, none of us had got the interview because you've got to speak to him. He was retiring. So we're under a load of pressure from our news editors. And when you said to them, "Well, we'll get a phone call from Carol when we can go," that was never good enough. You know, they said, "What do you mean you get a phone call off Carol? Just go and do it." Because they were used to ringing an MP up and just go down and speak to the MP about whatever you want. And we're trying to say, "Well, Brian Clough doesn't work like that." You know, this is... Anyway, we play Sheffield United on the Saturday and they get relegated.
Yeah.
When they played Ipswich, which was the last game in league football. But they'd still got the County Cup match to play on the Wednesday night, which was against Notts County, I think. And that was his last ever game in management. So we got a call on the Monday morning from Carroll. "The boss will see you 5 o'clock on Wednesday." Great. So I get down there at 5 o'clock and myself and Martin are sat together because Martin's had the call as well. So Brian arrives with Barbara. So that was good. So he goes down to the office and we get the call. So Martin and I go down together. So as you both know, if you're going to do an interview, and there's two of you, let the other person go first, warm the person up, and then you get the best one.
Yeah.
So I quickly get in. "You go, Martin. That's fine. You go. I know you're in a rush." So Cluffy said to me, "You go." So I've got, okay. So I get the ewer going. And of course, for people who think, what's this ewer that he's talking about? It's a recording machine with two spools of tape on. And when the tape runs out, that's you finished. You can't do anything about it until you take it back, get it off and clean it. So the ewer starts and we do the bog standard goodbye interview. You know, "How do you want to be remembered? Greatest thing you did, blah, 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 blah." Did all that, finished off. "Have you got enough? Yes. Are you sure? Do you need to ask me anything else? No. Really enjoyed working with you. You know, we'll work together again." So I go to leave. And he says, "Sit down." So I've sat back down. So Martin starts. So Martin asks the first question. And he just stares back at him. No answer. So the reel is going round and round and round and round. So Martin asks another question. Round and round and round. And just nothing coming back. Just silence. So he asks a third question. And he got up and he walked out the office. So I'm sat on the settee, suppressing laughter. I'm looking at Martin's face. He's ashen. I mean, he's completely ashen. So that's making me laugh. But I think Brian sees me laughing, I'm going to be in trouble when he comes back in. But I also feel for Martin because he's my pal. But you can't help but giggle because it's one of these Monty Python scenarios that's developing here. So he walked back in and answered the question. So he's now got one. He's got one answer. So he asks another one, and he gets up, walks to the coat peg in the corner of the office, and he got a flat cap on the coat peg, and it was the flat cap that Eric Morecambe had given him, and it always hung on the peg in the office. So he picks the peg off, walks back to the kind of the middle of the room, and skims it like James Bond, and hangs it on the peg, sits down and answers the question. So this goes on until the tape runs out. Every question was followed by the hat being done onto the peg, and then he'd sit down and do the thing. So Martin's probably got about, I don't know, a minute, Brian Clough, and this 10-minute reel's just gone now, just flapping around. So off we go. We get out of the office, and Martin said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? If I take that back, I can't take that back. What am I going to do? So I said, right, all we can do is, you'll have to take mine, go back, edit it, edit all the answers out, put your questions into my answers. I'll run it as it is, but you run it with your different questions. Nobody will ever know. And you know what? We got away with it. Nobody ever knew. Nobody ever knew. So Martin went back with a fine interview, great, put his questions in, quick, edited it all out, ran it, and nobody knew. Got away with it. To this day, nobody knows. I don't know whether Martin's ever told the story. Well, I've told it now, but we laugh about it. But that, there was something different every time. It was like you never just turned up and sat down and did an issue and went away. There was always something that it would be memorable for, that he'd tell you or would happen or... But it was bonkers. But I mean, you're talking about one of the iconic managers of our generation. But every time you were in his company, it left you with something. So he got the freedom of the city of Nottingham. And it was the same scenario again. Are you going to speak to him? This was after he'd retired. Everything still went through Carroll at the ground. And again, I get the call that I'm going to see him the day before. So this might have been a Thursday. I get the call on a Tuesday that I'll see him on the Wednesday. So I go to the ground, and Carroll said, the boss said, wait in the car park. So I'm stood in this sunny day, stood in the car park, and a big green council limousine arrived with flags on the front, the Nottingham City Council emblem on the flag. So he comes out suited and booted. He said, get yourself in the car. So I sit in the back of the car with Cluffy. So I said, oh, you know, where are we going, Mr. Clough? Because you couldn't call him Brian. Mr. Clough, or that was it. Where are we going, Mr. Clough? So he said, it's a dress rehearsal for tomorrow. I thought you'd enjoy it. So I've gone off with Brian Clough and this bloke from the council, and we've done the entire dress rehearsal together of this Freedom of the City. So I'm playing the part of the Lord Mayor, and Cluffy's walking in, and I'm giving him a box that he's getting the day after, and we've gone to this place where he's planting a tree. And of course, we've done the whole thing, you know. And then he dropped me off back at the radio station 4 hours later when we'd done it.
Yeah.
With this interview about, but he was that was just what he was like. He was just, he could be your worst enemy or your best friend, and everything he did was kind of spontaneous. And when it was your day or your week or your moment, you got a memory that will live with you for the rest of your life. Yeah. And he was very good at doing that. But he could absolutely cut you down. He wouldn't, if he got something to say, it wouldn't matter who was there, what the circumstances were, he'd just do it. And I could probably write a book myself based on just the time I had with him. And I think everybody that worked around him would tell you the same. But it was a mad time and a wonderfully special time all rolled into one.
Yeah.
Normally it's one or the other, isn't it? Somebody's either completely zany and off the wall or absolutely wonderful. And I think that the magical aspect of him was that he was able to do all of it. So you never really knew. You know, it was like a different episode every time you went. And you think, well, what happened last week? That was just what it was like. It was mad.
Well, it toughens you up, I'm sure, for all the tests that were to come later in your career. In your early days at Capital then, Gary, I mean, you'd have had to deal with managers. I can't imagine there was anybody you would come close to giving you the sort of jip that Mr. Clough gave Fletch.
No, not a Capital.
Apart from Piercy, by the way. I would think Piercy
Piercy was the problem, yeah. No, it was later, obviously, when I was at Chelsea and I was dealing with Jose in his first spell. You know, that... not quite as iconic as that, but you know, there were definitely times where he could be. He was very, very good to me. I would probably speak to him once or twice a week, and he was very good to me. But there were times where he would cut you dead for no apparent reason, not because of anything you had done. But yeah, I mean, very, you know, very, really, really special time because he, you know, obviously won the league with Chelsea, and I was there on the open top bus, going through the streets of West London, and yeah, he was brilliant to me overall, particularly in that first spell. But I can't think of too many occasions at Capital where I had problems with managers because, you know, they were all fine. It was Harry Redknapp and Arsene Wenger and that lot. You know, they were brilliant with the media, weren't they?
Look at you.
Yeah. but when you mentioned JP there and how tough he could be as a boss, I mean, maybe we'll ask Fletcher in a bit just how tough Tony was and how difficult he made life and how tough he made things. Can you give us some examples of just, you know, it's kind of, I always talk about the Snoop sessions that I used to have as a presenter on BRNB, where you would have a cassette that would record every link and you would then put it under the program controller's door and he would bring you in the next day and absolutely crucify you for every link you've ever done. But somebody like JP would presumably get you in his office and would he play stuff back to you that you'd done or anything like that?
No, I mean, let me first of all say, I learned so much from JP and I'm incredibly grateful for it because again, he'd throw you in the deep end and you would, you know, you would be terribly nervous and get the job done. So I'm not going to slate him in any way. He was absolutely fantastic to me, but at the same time, what he enjoyed doing was making sure the message went in. So if he had something to say to you, he would do it while everyone was listening, you know, before we went on air, everyone's listening on talkback. And then the message would really ram home. Don't do that again. You know, so I'd kind of dread that bit between 1 and 2 o'clock when everyone was coming on air and he was talking and you wondered if, would he have something to say about what you said last week or what you said during the week? And you know, he could be brutal, absolutely brutal, but it didn't happen again. So, you know, what he did there with Capital was absolutely incredible. You know, won so many awards. And it's because he, you know, he was presenting football in a way that no one had ever done before. I wasn't even aware that there was a BBC radio station covering football because for me, it was all about Capital. I listened to all the major tournaments on that. Because, you know, they went out to the World Cup and the Euros and the Olympics as well. And you know, so many of those guys are now in our industry doing an amazing job, like yeah. Steve Wilson, like Bill Leslie, you know, so many of them. They were just, that they produced so many great broadcasters from that era. So what he did there, is truly amazing. And like I say, if you were a football fan in London at that time, it was all about Capital Gold.
But Fletch, actually, it kind of spread out that whole Capital Gold, the tentacles spread across the country. I benefited from that in the Midlands. And you did in the East Midlands.
Yeah, they bought us, you know, so we were bought out and Jonathan became my boss. And I remember at the time, I was in charge of the three stations that we had. So we had one in Derby, one in Leicester and one in Nottingham. So when Capital bought us, they became our boss. And he called me, and I've always got on famously with JP, and he's been so helpful to me down the line. He's always had good things to say about me to people, and it's helped me. And he's always been someone that I've looked up to and respected, and he's only ever helped me on my journey. And he called me the day that we were bought and he rang me and he said, look, don't worry about it. He said, you're fine up there. Crack on with what you're doing. You won't hear from me unless you need anything. If you do, give me a call, but if not, just get on with it. And he left us just to do what we did. But Capital did play an important part for me because when I was with Century Radio, they were owned by Capital. Mm-hmm. And they decided to cover the 2004 European Championships. So they sent me and Gary Weaver and Tony Gale to do it. So Gary from Manchester, me from Nottingham, Tony kind of representing London. And we went and did the tournament. And I ended up getting my commentary role at Five Live off the back of that tournament. I had a lot of help from a guy called Andy Kay in that regard. But that, so that was the influence and impact that Capital had on my career would have been Jonathan and the opportunity to do that tournament, which gave me a chance to be a commentator on a bigger stage than I was. I was a regional commentator at that time. So I had no national reach at all. And that was very helpful to me.
But did you enjoy the, we've spoken about it on previous episodes of this podcast, the kind of, well, for want of a better word, war that the BBC locals and the ILRs had with one another for listeners and for the audience. Obviously, as Gary's just mentioned, he wasn't even aware that BBC London were an entity. So
I never really felt any pressure for that, to be honest. I got on well with Martin and we did our thing and they did theirs. And I think it was a relatively level split. I think if anything, the BBC station in Nottingham might have had more listeners than we had. I don't know, because they were more committed to the football than we were. We'd do the games, but that was about it. But they'd do all the programming around it as well. So we were, I wouldn't say the poor relation, but we didn't do as much as they did. So I never really felt that. And just kind of going back to what Gary was saying about, you know, Jonathan getting his message across and making sure you got better. I think because of the way I started in the industry, everything I did was seen as a bonus by everybody because I wasn't supposed to be doing it. So I think they always looked at me through more positive eyes because I should be rubbish. So if I did a good job, it was like, wow, that's a bonus. We didn't expect that. Mm. So I didn't necessarily get the Snoop sessions because they didn't think I was going to amount to anything anyway. So everything I did was a bonus. So everything was looked on positively rather than negatively.
Yeah.
So it was a different scenario where Gary went into what was the Rolls Royce of sports broadcasting at that time. And when you got that place, it came with pressure. I never had that. So I've never experienced it. So I don't know. I was always a kind of, oh, that was good on Saturday because you're not supposed to be good. Which I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, guys, but that's how it was.
I think it's incredibly sad that those jobs in local commercial radio don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And it's really sad that, you know, we don't hear football on local commercial radio. I'm incredibly lucky that I came through that. And of course, later I did Chelsea games on, they sold the rights to Smooth FM, believe it or not. So I did several seasons covering the Chelsea games on London in FM, but on Smooth. So we would literally have a track by Earth, Wind and Fire, and then let's get the team news with Gary Taphouse. So yeah, that was, you know, crazy times, but...
I'm sure that was seamless, Gary. I'm sure that was absolutely seamless.
We were the same on Gem Gaz. It used to be the Doobie Brothers into the team news. It was never Earth, Wind and Fire. It was the Doobie Brothers or somebody like that.
But, you know, by then I was obviously working for Sky as well. So it gave me an opportunity to get some other commentators in when I wasn't available. Smooth were brilliant to me because they paid me a fee for getting the show ready and doing the interviews and then another fee for doing the comms. So even when I wasn't actually doing the on-air stuff, I was still getting paid. And I used people like Sam Matterface and Alex Crook, your colleagues, Dance, when I wasn't available. So... those were amazing times covering Chelsea for local radio, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't have kids at the time, so I could be away for however long it took. Incredibly long hours, but that's where I just learned everything about the industry.
And as you mentioned, the opportunity to then go and jump and work for Sky came from meeting Sky people on the gantry when you were doing your Chelsea duties.
Yeah, so Rob Hawthorne was really, really good to me. I'm sure you both know Rob really well. And I got talking to him and I said, I know that Sky are now doing these 3 o'clock games for what was Football First then. It's now Match Choice. And he said, well, yeah, actually, they are short of commentators because, you know, we double up, but there's still sometimes 6 or 7 games. And I said, well, I'd really like to do that. You know, would you have a listen to one of my commentaries and see what you think? And he did, and he rang me back and he gave me a very thorough critique. And he said, you know, I know the producer, John Lyles, I'll happily put in a good word for you if you want. And he did. Even then, I had to hassle John for about a year before he finally gave me a chance in 2005. on Fulham against Manchester City, and you know, I was absolutely petrified going into that first TV game.
Like Fletcher with the mic.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I was very close to just going off to be physically sick before we went on air. I was that nervous. But it actually went okay. And thankfully, that was 15 years ago, and they're still using me. And of course, I'm now doing live championship games as well, which is fantastic. And I'm really, really enjoying it. So, you know, they've been really, really good to me over the last 15 years. And thank God I didn't mess up that first game. It actually almost went horribly wrong for me on the second game, which was at Aston Villa. And
it would go wrong there.
Yeah. Well, I nearly didn't make it. I nearly didn't make it because I got to Euston on the train and I was in loads of time. And then suddenly everything went dark and there'd been a massive power outage at Euston and no trains were leaving. And I tried to get the tube and there were engineering problems on the tube. And I was really, really starting to panic. I was phoning my wife every few minutes saying, what should I do? And eventually I had to get a cab all the way from central London to Villa Park. I rang my producer and he just said, look, just sort it out. Just get there. Whatever you do, just get there. Rob Palmer's there doing Envision. He could step in if you don't make it, but just get there. And actually, Fletch, it was Gary Birtles I was with, right. Of course, found the whole thing so amusing. And I literally, and if you know Villa Park, on a match day, they close off the streets when it gets close to kickoff. So I had to run the last mile. And this was, 20-3. We go on air at 10-2. And I literally had to I hadn't written any team news or anything. I just had run up to the top of the gantry and it was literally breathless and then cue Gary. And as they said cue Gary, a massive gust of wind blew my notes away. So I literally had nothing. And again, I've got Bertels next to me who's giggling so much because he finds the whole thing. I wasn't finding it funny at all. I was thinking this is my career over at Sky before it's even begun. And there was a goal in the first minute. Sean Wright Phillips scored. And then there was another couple of goals in the first 15 or 20. I was all over the place, but somehow got through it. And but I think if I had been even just a few minutes later in that cab, and he had to go through roadworks on the hard shoulder. I told him my story and he made it his mission to get me there.
And you remember how much the fee was at the end of it?
Yeah, it was about 470 quid, I think. And Sky paid it, and they actually laid on a card to take me home as well on the way back. So they treat you right there.
There's a bit of a theme developing here with notes blowing away. You're not the first to mention that particular nightmare to me, Gary, on this podcast.
Well, that's how you learn to then put your notes inside plastic sheets so they can't blow away. You learn the hard way with all of these things, don't you? And I actually had another complete disaster a few years after that, where I missed a flight to Newcastle. I stupidly went to the wrong terminal and thought, oh, that's fine, I'll just go to the other terminal, not realizing that to get from one terminal to another at Heathrow is like a half an hour drive around the ring road. And I checked in too late. This was before online check-in was normal. I checked in too late. So I had to then book myself on the later flight, which was 1 o'clock. This is for a 3 o'clock kickoff from Newcastle Portsmouth. And as I went through, I could see my flight boarding, but obviously I couldn't board it. And we got on the flight and there was a delay because someone needed a seatbelt extension. They couldn't find one. And I was just going completely frantic here. And again, we got to the ground about 2:45. I've managed to get the team news from Dan O'Hagan, who was there for match of the day. And again, just about managed to get on air in time. And my producer, Nigel Dean, is a good friend of mine, has retired now. But he said to me, I rang him and he never, ever gets cross, Nigel. But he did just say, you really let me down today. And that was more cutting than anything else he could have said. And I think as a result of that, they then decided if you are going that far, you've got to go the night before. So, yeah, that could have been another career-ending moment. And I don't know if you've ever had that feeling in the pit of your stomach where you really are thinking, I'm running late here. This could go horribly wrong.
Once.
I've never had that since, and I never want to have it again.
I was stuck on the M61 trying to get to the Reebok Stadium for a Bolton-West Bromwich Albion game for Capital Gold. I was only doing reports, but there was a massive accident on the 61. and they'd shut the motorway. And I was about half a mile from the turning for the Reebok. I still don't know to this day whether there were any fatalities that day, you know, how serious the accident was up ahead. But to my right, I could see the stanchion, you know, the stanza of the Reebok in the distance. But in my head, all I can think is Tom is going to kill me. Tom is going he's going to eat me alive for this. Eventually, I got through. I missed the first 20 minutes of the game. Luckily, there were no goals. So my first update, 20 minutes into the game, sounded like I watched the whole thing. Somebody, some kind fella to my right, gave me a précis of what had happened in what I'd missed in the opening 20 minutes. But yet, from that moment on, it just resolved me to think, right, I'm getting to a game 3 hours before kickoff. It doesn't matter whether it's Papa John's trophy, whether it's WSL or whether it's Premier League. I'm getting there 3 hours before kickoff, just in case. I always leave myself, I'm sure you're the same, Fletch, you always leave myself that window in case.
Yeah, I was only late once. I was late for Leicester Wolves at Molineux early in my career. And I didn't know where Wolverhampton was. That was half the problem. So I got on the M1 and thought I'll find it eventually. And of course, you can't really get to Wolverhampton off the M1. So it took some
time. Funny that.
When I got there, it was into a program called Sabras Sound on Leicester Sound. And they didn't even know the game was on. So nobody cared that I was late. When I went to Chelsea for the first time, I make no bones about the fact that I shouldn't be doing the job that I do. I should be a manual labourer somewhere. So it's taken a lot of years to actually get to my mind working how it needs to around being places. Because I'd never really travelled. I'd lived in Nottingham and I'd not really been anywhere. So the first time I got sent to Chelsea, I kind of got to the bottom of the M1 with a road atlas, you know, and then thought, well, what do you do now? So I remember, this is a true story, it's crackers really. So I'm at the bottom of the M1 at Brent Cross, and I wound my window down to the car next to me and said to the guy in the car, how do you get to Chelsea from here, Brent Cross? And when the guy wound his window down, it's mad this, it was Nicholas Parsons. Can you remember him?
Yes, just a minute.
Nicholas Parsons, right, who's a Chelsea fan and said, I'm going to the game. So I followed Nicholas Parsons from Brent Cross to Stamford Bridge.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, mad. Absolutely mad. I mean, you can't make it up, can you?
No hesitation, repetition or deviation on that journey.
No. He just said,
and that's not a five-minute drive, by the way, is it?
No, that you've still got another good hour to go from that point.
I don't know why he was at the Brent Cross when I was, Nicholas Parsons, but he was off.
Wow.
I followed Nicholas Parsons to Chelsea, so yeah.
There you go. There's your autobiography title right there. I think that the book is closed on that one. Gary, one of the things that you do now, you've had a very long and distinguished career to this point already with Sky, but you're very generous with what you do. We've mentioned the fact that job opportunities are shrinking, certainly from a broadcast media point of view, in commercial radio. But every day on your Twitter feed and presumably on your other socials, you are forever posting job opportunities within this industry. Was there a particular reason why you started that? Was there something that fired, you know, I've got to help people, or what's the story behind it?
Well, yeah, what happened was about 6 years ago, UCFB at Wembley University asked me to put together a little module for their first years studying sports broadcasting, just about match commentary, and then deliver it. And I thought that was a really good opportunity to do something a bit different. So I did. And as a result of doing that, I said to the students, I do see the odd job opportunity, so I'll post it. And it just kind of snowballed from there. And very quickly, employers were starting to message me with jobs. And it's kind of like a second full-time job I've got now, because I don't even get paid for it. But yeah, I think basically most of the people following me are for that one reason. And it has just gone completely crazy. It takes a couple of hours of my day. And I think, you know, we've all talked about people who've helped us along the way, and none of us would be where we are if it wasn't for those people who've, you know, gone out on a limb and given us an opportunity. I just feel like we all owe it to the next lot coming through to try and do as much as we can to help. I mean, I try and get back to everyone who messages me. I mean, I can't physically do it. I've currently got 400 messages on my Twitter inbox that I haven't even replied to yet.
Wow. I
will get to them eventually, but you know, I do try to listen to people's demos. People have asked me to help with their applications, and I'll do that if I possibly got the time. As you know, we're spending half our lives prepping or traveling or doing matches, but if I can, I will. And so, yeah, it's just kind of gone a bit mad, really. But yeah, so every day now, my DMs are full of either employers saying, can you plug this job, or people saying, can you help me apply for this job? So, but it's great. It's really, really great. And it's been really rewarding because I've had so many people come back to me and say, I've actually got into the industry because of that job you posted. So thanks so much. So that, you know, that makes it all worthwhile.
There you go. It's the original selfless good deed, like Phoebe tried to do on Friends, isn't it? You know, that's not, it's not to be sniffed at, Gary.
Well, I try. You know, I'm sure I could do more. I'm sure we could all do more. But yeah. I'm trying to do as much as I can.
I feel a bit, and I don't know whether Fletch feels the same, but because my route in was so completely ridiculous and not textbook at all, that if somebody says, how do you get into the industry, I feel slightly fraudulent answering, because I was a guitar salesman who got lucky. Fletch was a suspended ceilings man who got a lucky break. Don't get me wrong, the hard work flipping well starts once you've had the lucky break. But I don't know, do you get what I mean, Fletch? It feels slightly fraudulent when people ask you in a, you know, and you're flattered to have been asked, but I don't know what answer I can give them.
No, I don't tend to get asked, actually. So I genuinely don't. I don't. People don't tend to ask me how to get into the industry.
They're scared of you. That's what it is. They're scared of you.
But I'm like you. I wouldn't know. I mean, what I say to everybody, if people do ask me, you know, could you give me some advice? I always say, well, not really, because it's your journey, and we're all different, and we all want to do different things. And I feel sorry for people now that you can't get into the industry the way that we did, dance, that you can't come in through the back door, or as I did, through the cellar, because those opportunities, as Gary mentioned earlier, don't exist, you know, because there aren't. I remember when I started, you could commentate on Nottingham Forest for Radio 5, Radio Nottingham, Radio Trent, or Hospital Radio. So there were four jobs around one game straight away. Now it's only one. Really, if you're not doing BBC local, you're not doing it. So just by that, you know, the law of averages tell you that it's even harder to get in. But I also think as well, and I think this is a real problem for people now coming into the industry. The world's changed. And we live in a world now where we want everything yesterday, or we certainly want it tomorrow. And I think that I started doing my job in 1990. And I got to BBC Radio 5 Live in 2004. So I spent 14 years learning what to do. And then from that point on, I went to BT Sport in 2012, another 8 years doing that. And I fear that people won't stick at it for long enough. And I say to everybody who comes in, write the next 15 years off. Because if you think you're going to get my job in 5 years, you're not. It just doesn't work that way, because there's people ahead of you in the queue, further down the road, more experienced, learn more. It's you can't do this job quickly. You can't get to where you want to go quickly unless you're very, very lucky. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a very small percentage.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's just stages, isn't it?
No matter how good you think you are, or how good other people think you are, you still have to wait for the opportunity to develop, and you've got to learn. And I think you've got to be prepared. As I say to people as well, you have to do a lot of things that you don't want to do to get there. You know, you've got to stand out in the rain at a car park and get bombed out and have to go back tomorrow and maybe the next day. And if that's not you, don't do it, because you can't get to the top of the profession where you want to be unless you do all the other stuff to get there. There is no fast track. And I always say to people, you've just got to write off a chunk of your life, because you might have been and done a course, you might have got this degree, you might be ultra talented, but there's still no fast process to get you there. And that's what I tell everybody all the time. Just be prepared for this to take a bloody long time, and you're going to be knackered, you're going to be despondent, you're going to want to quit. But it's such a great opportunity that why wouldn't you do it the long way like everybody else has? And I say to them, it's everybody that's done it. It's not just you that's got it. We've all done it. You know, we've all sat there and thought, oh God, you know, what are we going to do here? Because this is just, I'm never going to get anywhere with this. And then all of a sudden somebody says, I like you, you're good, you did that well. This break occurs, you know, whoever it is, a person, a game, a moment, whatever it can be, and it can change your direction. But you've just got to be prepared to put the time in and learn the job and earn the right to do it and build your relationships and refine your skills. And a lot of this is down to you rather than other people to do it for you. There is no career path. You know, you can join a company and think, if I go through this career path, I can become the line manager and then whatever it is over a period of time. There is a progression for you via what you do.
I was spectacularly naive in not seeing the career path that was potentially laying out in front of me. So you start with the flying eye, and then you start getting shifts on the air doing the Elvis hour. Then comes a chance to do a match report. Then you get a chance to do a commentary. At all these stages, at all those blocks in my career, I wasn't thinking, yeah, that's what I've been aiming for. It just happens. The first time I met Trevor Francis to interview him before a game, I mean, this is a guy I'd absolutely... I mean, what could I say about this super boy? And the first thing I did, I got to interview Trevor before a game at Bristol Rovers in a cup game. I was working for Capital Gold at the time. So this is late 90s, early 2000s. The first thing I did after I switched off my Marantz, we moved on from the Ura in those days. So we sort of progressed to cassette-based recording machines. But the first thing I did, I rang my dad. I didn't think about sending the audio back to Birmingham. The first thing I was thinking, I've got to ring the old man. I've got to tell him I've just spoken to Trevor bloody Francis. Yeah. And I rang it, because 10 minutes flew by with me and my dad just scratching our heads collectively. He's going, you've just interviewed Trevor. And I'm going,
The thing is, though, you've got to keep that. I feel like that now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 50. I've been doing the job a long time. But I feel like that now. Myself and Steve McManaman were in Rome two or three seasons back. And I looked to my left and Zico was doing co-commentary. Bloody Zico from the 82 World. There's Zico. Macca's going, yeah, Zico. And I refused to leave the stadium until Zico had finished working and I'd had my picture took with Zico. And I hope that never, ever leaves me. And I'll say to my boy when I get back, that's Zico. Who's Zico? So I show him Spain 82 and the Brazil team that didn't win the World Cup but should have done. And he's like, wow, what a player is. I said, exactly. That's why Macca's fallen out with me for making him stand in a stadium in the cold for an hour, waiting for Zico to stop working. And I've then sent Macca in to make the introductions. So I said, you go and talk to him first. Because I was, you can never lose that. I walk into work every Saturday, every Tuesday, every Wednesday, and I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And I think day I lose that, I've got to stop. Because if you don't feel that, you're in the wrong job. And I feel like it day after day after day after day. I'm sat this morning, I've stopped, I'm doing Watford Liverpool for BT on Saturday.
Yeah.
Today's my main prep day. And I'm excited to find things out that I can hopefully tell people on Saturday. And even that process turns me on. You know, it's I don't know, you've just got to feel like that. And surely, guys, the people you speak to, the students that you help, you know, surely you reinforce that point and you hope that they feel that way too.
Well, a lot of them are surprised. They think that the degree is the passport to the job. And I say to them, listen, the universities are churning out hundreds of you guys every single year and there aren't the jobs for all of them. What's going to make you stand out? It's you've got to get experience. You know, like I was lucky enough to get at Bournemouth, that was my part. It wasn't the degree. The degree didn't help me get into commentating. It was the fact that I'd done some commentating. So I always say to them, use this time. You've got time as a student. Go and approach some non-league clubs or a lower league club and say, what can I do? You know, use me. I'm available. I'm studying journalism. I know what I'm doing. and just make yourself available and have some tangible proof that you can do the job when you leave this place. And I think some of the first years really do think that they're there and this is what's going to get them ahead in the industry. And that the degree is kind of these days, it's the bare minimum. Yeah. All the jobs that I'm plugging on Twitter, the degree is kind of like a, it's an essential, it's not a desired. So it's everything you do on top of that that's going to make you stand out. And that's what I try and reinforce again and again.
Amazing, isn't it? Well, it, yeah, the degree was something I never even considered. I've mentioned this before, that the idea of going to university as a teenager was anathema to me. I just wasn't in the least bit interested. Well, of course, in those days, I had different delusions. I thought I was going to be a rock star, so university wasn't the place for me.
You'll always be a rock star to me, don't you worry about that.
Thank you very much indeed.
No, don't you worry about that.
I'm here all week. Now, one thing you have been able to do, Fletch, as well as football commentary, you've done. You have a love for American sports, and you've done a lot of great work with NFL, and I'm sure you must be so thrilled the transition that NFL has made to come across to this country. You've done games at Wembley Stadium, of course, now Tottenham has their specific pitch. But you've also done Major League Baseball commentary as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, it came about because BT Sport have got the rights to MLB over here, and they decided to follow the NFL pattern and play a couple of games in London. So BT decided that if we were going to do that, we should present it and we should commentate on it and we should do it in-house. And I think I was the biggest baseball fan in the room. So, well, you do it then, you know, it's kind of you do it. So Craig Doyle presented it and I commentated on it with Josh Chetwynd, who'd done some work on Channel 5, well known to British baseball fans.
So how did you approach it then? Were you listening to the MLB commentators in the States?
Kind of, but I think if you're going to do another sport, the worst thing you can do is try and copy somebody else. Mm-hmm. Because I think it's got to be about you. So when I did the NFL, I thought I'm going to do the NFL my way. And people will either like it or they won't, but that's the way I do it. And I thought I'd do the same with the baseball. So I kind of understood the mechanics of it. So you've got to always be balls and strikes. You've got to be telling the audience that. But after that, you've got a bit of a free rein to do it. So I thought, you know, this is pretty much test match special American style, you know. So you've got to do it a little bit like that. And an English audience, a British audience needs a bit more than a US audience, because I find with a thing like that, the balance is being annoying to people who know the sport by ramming the rules up the backside and the nuances, but also making it accessible for everybody who isn't a fan, but they know that, you know, these two great teams, the Yankees and the Red Sox, are in London and they want to know what the fuss is all about. But you've got to help them through the game as well. So I just did it the way that I thought I should do it, expecting an avalanche of stick. Get this guy off. I like baseball. Where's the American bloke? Who's this prat? You know. But actually, it was super positive. It was one of the best Twitter experiences, if you can have it, that I've ever had. It was actually positive. It was great. You thought, wow, I'm looking forward to tomorrow.
And you'll have to let me know how that feels, Fletch.
I will. I've not had it before or since, Gaz, so I'm back with you now. But the crazy thing was, I then started getting contacted by people in the US because MLB had put my commentary on their website. So all of a sudden, the English guy's doing the baseball. So like we sit here and go, the American guy sounds good, don't we?
Yeah.
They're going, he's all right, English fella. So now they're saying, can you come on this podcast? Can you come on this radio show? The English guy's doing the baseball. And I'm using English terminology that they wouldn't use. So their baseball calls sound mad because it's not what they'd say. Well, I'm saying it as an Englishman. So I'm using our phraseology and our terms and the kind of things we'd say. Yeah. Well, they thought it was great because they've never heard it before. So all of a sudden, I've become this like quirky guy that does the baseball in America. So I had this mad few days where I was speaking to radio stations in New York and Boston and going on podcasts. And they're all saying, you know, how many baseball games have you done? And I'm saying, well, that was my first one, you know, and it's crackers. And then they were saying, oh, the call on this home run was great. And MLB at the end of the year did their top 50 plays of the year. And I was in there for two of them. It was mad. Somebody sent me this link. He's sitting there thinking, this is crackers, because I've just kind of sat there and made it up as I've gone along. And it's one of those things where people either really like it or they don't. And in this case, people liked it, or a lot of people liked it. But in America, it was received way differently than it would have been here. So it was a shame that we couldn't do it last year because of COVID, because they were coming back again. They were bringing the Cardinals and the Cubs, and we were going to have another go. I don't know whether they'll ever do it now, whether it's lost its momentum, I'm not sure. But it is one of those things where I think you've got to have the confidence to sit down and go, I've been given this opportunity and this challenge. How do I think I should do it? Mm. You know, it's pointless me thinking, right, how would Joe Buck do the World Series? And I'm going to do that with an English accent. Because they'd be saying, this guy's trying to be Joe Buck. And he's not as good as Joe Buck, because I'm not. So why would you do that? You're better off going, I'm going to do it like this. This is how I do it. And at least you're being honest to yourself. And I'd say that to anybody who wants to get into commentary. Let your own personality dictate the way you do that sport, whether it's boxing, whatever it is, be you.
Yeah.
Don't ever be afraid to be yourself, because you can't fake it. You can't hide it. You're going to do that many games that ultimately people are going to find out who you are and what you are. So go and be you, you know, go and be you and be proud of yourself and let your personality be the broadcaster that you are. You know, I listen to you guys and you are the people that I know when you broadcast. So that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, and walking into a foreign world like darts, as I did as a commentator 3 years ago, again, yeah, you're absolutely right, Fletch. The idea is you've still got to be you. It's a journey into the unknown, because darts hasn't been on the radio since the early days of Talk Sport, and it didn't last very long then, but you felt that responsibility, right, we're going to make this work. So you're chatting with Paul Nicholson and Chris Mason, two of the best dart players this country's ever produced, but you're having a long, right, how are we approaching this? We just had a sensible 2-hour chat over about 5 beers, but by the end of the night, we had a perspective on how we were going to approach it, and I've loved every single second. I don't know how many...
But you see, you could have gone. I'll tell you what I'm going to go and do now. I'm going to go and watch the best darts commentary I can find.
Yeah.
Which would be Sid Waddell. I'm going to try and do a bit of that. But you're never going to get there, are you?
No, not a chance.
You're better off being you. And if that's good enough, great. Yeah. And if it's not, go away and work on it and come back.
Yeah, well, somebody would tell me if it wasn't good enough. Yes. How many different sports have you done, Gary, other than football? Have you turned your hand to anything else?
I did a couple of years at Wimbledon. Which I found incredibly grueling, because...
Was this TV or radio?
The radio, yeah. Because obviously matches are long. They're not 90 minutes. They can be 4 hours. And I found that even finding time to go to the loo, it was impossible. So the guys that cover tennis on a regular basis, I've got so much respect for, because it's tough and it's grueling. And of course, just trying to describe a long rally for radio... talking about forehand side and backhand sides and down the line, and I mean, they do an absolutely incredible job. I think that's the
toughest commentary gig of the lot for me.
I listen to Russell and Gigi on 5 Live, and honestly, they are fantastic. They really are, and they really do bring it to life. Anything else, I think I'd just be a fraud, to be honest. So no, I've never looked to do anything else. And as we know, there's enough football to keep us all very busy. I think if I did it, even actually this season, I was asked to do some WSL, and I thought, do you know what? I just don't know enough about that at the moment. So
you know what? I did my first WSL last weekend, the Manchester Derby at Lee Sports Village. And I had that horrible moment in the back of your mind. Georgia Stanway got sent off a straight red card. And of course, what does muscle memory do in your brain as a commentator? It makes you want to say down to 10 men.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the back of my brain, don't say it. It's something clicks into gear. So I ended up just saying down to 10, because somehow for me, saying down to 10 women didn't sound quite right. Somehow it's not entered the lexicon quite yet as a phrase that we've become used to in the same way that down to 10 men. So honestly, for the rest of that game, whenever I was bringing up the fact that Manchester United had a player advantage, not a man advantage, and saying down to 10, I've never had to concentrate so hard for ages in a commentary to make sure I didn't make that simple but pretty fundamental mistake.
It's odd, isn't it? Because you do different things. I've started doing a bit of boxing recently. So I've done a few fights for Five Live, and I've always been a massive boxing fan. I've always fancied doing it. And it is a sport that I've followed for a long time. So I have a base knowledge of doing it. And you'd kind of sit there and go, well, each round's 3 minutes. So surely you can talk for 3 minutes. But it's, it goes back to what Gary says about the tennis game, that it's avoiding repetition, because the same thing happens over and over again for the 3 minutes. And in a tennis match, the same shots happen over and over again. It's either a backhand or forehand, but it's the same thing. But if it's a long rally in tennis, I would imagine you can start repeating yourself really easily. And in boxing, you can as well. How do you describe the same thing in a different way? And I sat down with Mike Costello before the Josh Warrington fight, who I think's the best at it. And I said to Mike, I said, give me some pointers here. So Mike gave me a bit of a crash course in kind of what you do. But even then, it's like so different and so difficult to do it. Because I think the art of good commentary is just, it just flows out of you. It is what it is. And you're not always going to get everything right. You're not going to get a lot wrong, but you're not going to get everything right. You are going to say the odd thing wrong every now and again. But it flows out of you, and it's natural, and it's comfortable, and it's as though you sat next to people and you're chatting about the game. I get that.
Mm.
I think when you do another sport, you don't feel that way. It's like you. Half your brain during the game is thinking about the mechanics of it,
and
the other half is trying to let it flow, and it becomes really difficult to do.
Yeah,
I find doing a 3 minute boxing round harder than doing the Champions League final, because it's just alien compared to what I've done for years and years and years. And I always say to people, if you're going to do something else, you've got to make sure that they give you enough opportunities to do it so you become comfortable. It's pointless doing one every now and again, because by the time you get any kind of momentum, it's finished. And then you've got to wait for your chance. I always say to people, if you're going to do another sport, you've got to make sure you can do a cluster of events, a group of them, or in Gary's case, Wimbledon, because Gary would have been, I'm sure, not speaking for you guys, but I'm sure you would have been more comfortable by the final than you were opening day, because you built that rhythm up over the fortnight.
Yeah, they wouldn't let me loose on the final, Fletch.
Well,
but you're right. Yeah. And it's like football, isn't it? I mean, I can't listen to anything that I did 15 years ago, because you only get better by doing it. Sky showed Portsmouth 7, Reading 4 recently, and that probably was only about my fifth or sixth game.
Really?
And, I just thought it sounded terrible. I just thought, God, how they kept giving me games, I don't know. But, you know, you only get better at doing this job by doing it. And I think probably you're still learning until your final game, to be honest.
I'm still learning with the darts, because again, with the darts, like Fletch says, with the boxing, how many different ways can you describe a dart hitting the treble 20? It becomes about the psychology of the sport for me, as much as you're watching the facial expressions of the players. And if I wasn't doing a good enough job, then Nico and Mace would, you know, that they would see straight through me. So you're right. Finding different ways of describing the same thing, that's one of the great skills that you have to try and master, whichever sport you happen to be commentating on. It's very, very true, Fletch. Very, very true. And look, you guys have you know, managed to sustain a fantastic career, which is nowhere near done. I mean, Fletch, you know, you do still work on radio, as you mentioned, doing a bit of boxing, but TV's your bread and butter.
Yeah.
And BT's been really good to you since you came on board there. And of course, we all wonder, the thing we all have that slight concern about is when the next rights issue, when the next negotiation comes along, and what that could potentially do to us or people around us. It's never totally secure, is it, this game?
No, I mean, you know, hopefully. The BT situation is fine for now. You know, we've got a new Premier League contract that's been agreed, and Sky the same. The Champions League contract has just started again. You never get security, really, but your security comes in the length of the rights package. So you live rights package to rights package. But you're exactly right. BT have been really good to me. And they were prepared when I was a radio commentator to allow me to learn how to be a TV commentator on television, which not a lot of people would have done. I think they would have wanted a television person to come in and be a television commentator. Grant Best and Simon Green were good enough to help me through that and let me learn how to be a TV commentator. And I don't mind saying, for the first two and a half years of my existence with them, I used to be petrified to go to work because I couldn't do the job. I knew I couldn't do it as well as I wanted to do it. I knew I didn't sound like the other people. Everybody was telling me on social media that as well, and you just got to take it because they were right. And it was a long period before I actually sat down and thought, you know what, I actually know how to do this now. It's different, and I've got a semblance of confidence in myself to do it. And from that point on, I've absolutely loved it. But it wasn't an easy transition. I just couldn't get it. You know, so then one day the penny dropped and I thought, right, I get it. It wasn't a gradual thing. It was just like, I turned up for one game and thought, okay, that was different. Because I watch everything back. Every game that I do, I watch it back that day. So if I do a Champions League game at Anfield on a Tuesday night, I'll get back at 1 a.m. and I'll sit and watch the 90 minutes before I go to bed. Because by doing that, I know why I said what I said at that time. If I watch it the following day, I've lost my train of thought from the night before. I'm just watching it as though it's somebody else's game. But I want to try and be better. So I watch everything. Every game I do, I watch it back in full. If I'm overseas, I'll watch it in the hotel before we go somewhere else and do it. So I'm really big on that. It's really big for me. Some people would do that. Some people wouldn't. I feel comfortable doing it. I watch everything. Don't miss a minute. So to sit down after every game and watch it and not like it is tough. But it also gives you the motivation to go, I've got to get better. Because I'm sitting there thinking, if I don't enjoy it, the poor buggers at home can't be enjoying it, can they? I can't sit back and say, you've done all right there, pal. Everybody else is thinking, who's this fella? So it was a difficult transition. I don't mind admitting it. I found it really tough. But now, I think if you said to me now, go and do a radio commentary, I'd be all over the place. Because it is so different. I'd want to leave gaps and I shouldn't be doing. And I'd be thinking, what do you say in these moments? I used to know what to say, but now I wouldn't. So they are totally different. I mean, it's a different job.
What ambitions do you hold still, Gary? I mean, as I say, you've been a permanent fixture at Sky for well over a decade now, getting on for 20 years. What do you feel is left to achieve for yourself?
Yeah, only 15. I'm not that old. Listen, I just want to carry on doing what I'm doing, really. Like I say, the last couple of years, the EFL guys have been really, really good to me, and I've started doing a lot more games there, and I'm really, really enjoying that. So this Saturday will be match choice at Southampton, but then I'm doing Stoke against Bournemouth on Tuesday night. I'd love to do more of those. Obviously, you always want to do more, don't you? I'm very lucky I do stuff away from Sky as well. You know, I do the Europa League World Feed. I do stuff for Premier League Productions as well, who were brilliant to me during the lockdown when obviously every game was live. I was working for them very regularly. So I work for a lot of people. I do the Carabao Cup for Pitch International. I'll be at Chelsea Southampton in a couple of weeks for them. So I just want to keep doing what I'm doing, really. And if further opportunities come along, then fantastic. But right now, I couldn't actually fit anything in.
Well, if any job opportunities come up with Pitch International, Premier League, can you put a tweet out so I know to apply?
Yeah, it will do. Yeah, I'll send you a DM, Dance.
That's very kind. That's very kind indeed. Good on you, Gary. Listen, fellas, we've gone well over an hour, but it's been an absolutely fascinating hour chatting with a pair of you. I really want to thank you for giving up your time, because it is prep day, as you rightly say, Fletch. I'll actually see you at Southampton, Gary, at the weekend. I will be at St Mary's with Perry for our TalkSport 2 commentary for the Southampton Leeds game. You say you're off to Vicarage, Fletch, yeah?
I am, yeah. We've got Vicarage Road on Saturday, and then we're off to Madrid on Tuesday for Liverpool, and then back for Manchester United, Atalanta on Wednesday night. And I tell you, the busiest people at the moment are the team that organised the travel at BT, because let me tell you, these flights don't exist. So it's all right, the airlines saying, you know, we need people to get on the planes. Let me tell you, airlines, we need planes to get on. So what should be a relatively straightforward trip from the UK to Madrid and back again is an absolute nightmare for everyone.
I don't know whether William Shatner's rocket might be available for you to use.
So, Fletch, you'll be in Madrid, I'll be in Stoke.
Right,
say no more.
Well, it
takes all sorts, doesn't it? You know,
it's good for you to get home, guys, I'll give you that.
True, that's very true. I'll need the heated blanket.
I might not see you, Gary, but I might be able to detect the warm glow of the heated blanket because, of course, you commentate on the other side of the stadium from where I'm sat.
There, Dan's thinking, why is the Ready Breck man doing the game on the
deck? Exactly.
I'm really hoping that we don't need the heated blanket in October. Well, listen, I'll take it just in case.
We are getting close, aren't we? Once the clocks go back, then the thermals do come out of the cupboard. I think we're all happily aware of that sudden change in temperature where, okay, we've got to up our game here. We've underclubbed. There's always one game a season where you either underclub or overclub on the clothing. But it's much more fun overclubbing than underclubbing. That's for sure. Fletch, Gary, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you both, and all the best for the rest of the season. And I'll see you on Saturday, Gary.
Cheers, Dan. Cheers, Fletch.
Thank you, Dan. See you, guys.
So that's Darren Fletcher and Gary Tapas with me. My thanks to them on the commentator's curse. There'll be another episode along next week. I think we'll reach double digits next week. But thank you for listening. Rate, review, subscribe, all that malarkey. And we'll speak to you next time on the commentator's curse.